Hello, I am your noble, robotic, introducer, and this is the Class War Battlefield Podcast. Welcome to episode 2021.01.01. This podcast is being published on Sunday, February 7th, 2021. If you would like a copy of today's episode, download it for free at radio, the number 4. ALL.net. That's radio, the number 4. ALL.net. You can also download episodes from iTunes, Google Podcast, and Anchor.fm. You can reach out to your host if you have any questions at radio, the number 4. ALL.net and Anchor.fm. Today's presentation is entitled Economic Reckoning on the Horizon. It's time we, the people, have an intervention in the lives of the economically obese. It is the second segment from a multi-part episode, which has been thematically titled America's Next Step. Now, on with the episode.
And now,
the definition.
This next clip is from Fox Business Network, and it's also from The Twilight Zone. So they're going to admit that income inequality is way out of whack, which is amazing. Never thought I'd see the day that Fox Business is like, you know, you got a point with that income inequality thing. But the other thing they do is they start openly discussing, like, hey, maybe the Fed will do some sort of universal basic income program. Maybe they'll start, instead of doing what they always do for Wall Street and the financial institutions, maybe they'll do that for regular people who kind of need it. Watch this.
You know, doesn't it seem like capitalism often provides the best ammunition for progressives, their case to reshape it? After publicly decrying income inequality, J.P. Morgan Chase CEO Jamie Dimon's 2020 pay, it held steady, $31.5 million. I'm going to bring in BMO Capital Markets Chief Strategist Brian Belsky. Brian, we're going to talk markets later, but I got to talk to you about this. Now, J.P. Morgan, its stock did well. The company held up pretty well. But my goodness, I mean, are they sort of blind to the winds that are swirling around? Because I know Jamie Dimon always says the right thing, but when he takes that kind of money, he gives a lot of ammunition to AOC and company.
He really does. Thanks for having me. And you're going to throw me out after mentioning that some guy made $32 million. We're us on Wall Street. We've seen pay go down for 10 straight years. I know, get the violin out, right? But listen, you know, what, I think people fail to remember that political contributions are basically even on both sides. They got to do an investment tactic called a straddle. And even though you hear a lot of press about this money being pulled on one side, let's give it a couple of years, Charles, and we'll see what happens in 2022. But I think some of this is just one of these symptoms of let's kick a dog while they're down, and I think it'll slowly go away. But you're absolutely spot on. This is only giving additional ammo to that side that in terms of income distribution and all of that stuff.
Right, income inequality. But I got to tell you, I'm not as sanguine as you are. In fact, I think there are plans right now to hijack the Federal Reserve. And here's the thing. They're going to say, why don't we point this money-making, this money-printing machine that's always printed at Wall Street and turn it to the have-nots? Even the Fed, if you listen to the Fed real close, they admit that they exacerbate the income inequality thing, right? That they make the wealthiest people out there wealthier, which is fine. I mean, everyone can invest in the stock market. But, I mean, when I listen to the folks who are in the Fed, who are coming into the Federal Reserve, Biden, Yellen, I believe that they might actually do something like that in terms of, hey, let's just print money and give it to Main Street.
Well, a couple things to watch as leading indicators, as we like to call in the business. I mean, remember, I don't think enough has been made in terms of Yellen's not only chairmanship of the Fed for a few years, but she was on the Fed Board of Governors for a long, long time. So her tentacles run deep in the Fed. But I think also, too, Charles, we haven't seen a lot of dissension for several years from voting members of the Fed. Start watching for more of that. I mean, if that's going to start, then we could actually see maybe the semblance of what you're indeed talking about.
That was amazing. So they're talking about how the Fed might turn around and do some sort of UBI program for the American people. I mean, if I was a betting man, I'd say I don't think so. But it's interesting that even the people on Fox Business who are extremists are at the point where they're thinking, well, obviously people need help and they're incredibly desperate and this would be some sort of solution, because you know what? That is the exact solution that's always been used for the financial institutions in Wall Street. They just get money thrown at them nonstop whenever, you know, they hit a bad spot, you know? So I think, you probably would have to do a program like that through Congress. You'd have to have it approved through Congress. I don't think the Federal Reserve can really take it into their own hands to do a program like that. But it's fascinating to me that they're casually talking about it. Now, the other thing is, on income inequality, their point is, income inequality is obviously making us look bad, making capitalists look bad, because clearly it shows that AOC is right and her concern is reasonable. That, like, you know, Jamie Dimon making whatever it was, $32 million or something in 1 year. And it's like, yeah, you're not helping, dude. $32 million in 1 year? Like, yeah, income inequality is a problem, and you're a great example of how it's a problem. Look at the fact that 60% of the businesses that shut as a result of COVID are now shut permanently. About 30% can't pay their housing bill. Thankfully, we have temporary moratoriums on that, but when that runs out, what the hell's going to happen? You know? I remember we covered a story last year. There was a study that came from the RAND Corporation. They said that the top 1% has stolen $47 trillion from the bottom 90% since 1974. In other words, if you took the income distribution in the post-World War II climate in that multi-decade time frame, and you had the same income distribution moving forward, the bottom 90% would be $47 trillion wealthier. So people have gotten absolutely obliterated and screwed by this system. It's the lack of unionization now. It's the fact that money controls our politicians, and so they're making decisions that are rigged in favor of the top 1% in the corporations. These are the things that have perverted the decision-making process, which then, in turn, biases the system against regular people. And it's now so extreme that we're at the point where Fox Business hosts are like, you know, the left has been bitching about wealth and income inequality, and I have to say they kind of have a point when you look at the numbers. Exactly. Exactly. And funny enough, what they're saying would be a solution. Now, again, you could debate whether or not the Fed can do it or if it has to go through Congress, but according to that same RAND Corporation study, if you had the same income distribution as you did in the post-World War II phase, the golden age of economic expansion, as it's called, every single person in the bottom 90% in this country would have made an extra, I believe the exact number was $1,144 per month, every month, in their lives. So yeah, funny enough, a universal basic income program would be the way to sort of redress this problem, redress this grievance, to fix it. And so they stumble on that. But, you know, I doubt they're actually for it. But just the fact that they're talking about it really is something to see. The what is possible is changing right in front of our eyes. We really are entering a new phase in American history. We went from FDR's New Deal era to the Reaganomics, you know, drown the government in the bathtub era. And now, because of the pandemic, because of the subsequent depression, you could also argue because of the recession from 2009, people have had enough and they're fed up, and you can see the landscape shifting in front of us where now things are in the conversation that never previously would have been in the conversation. And that's a good thing, because these are absolutely necessary, vital solutions to our problems.
Today's topic is obesity. Obesity is a medical condition involving an abnormal or excessive fat accumulation that presents a negative effect on health. Obesity is defined as having a body mass index, or BMI, of 30 kilograms per square meter or more. The range 25 to 30 kilograms per square meter is defined as overweight. A body mass index is a measurement obtained by dividing a person's weight by the square of the person's height. Obesity is further evaluated in terms of fat distribution around the waist or waist circumference. Men with a waist measurement of 94 centimeters or more and women with a waist measurement of 80 centimeters or more are more likely to develop obesity-related health problems. Obesity is a chronic medical condition that increases your risk of diseases and health problems, particularly certain types of cancer, cardiovascular diseases, type 2 diabetes, osteoarthritis, infertility, irregular periods, non-alcoholic fatty liver, and obstructive sleep apnea. Obesity can also affect your quality of life and lead to psychological problems such as depression, low self-esteem, shame, guilt, and social isolation. Obesity is more common in women than in men. Obesity is a leading preventable cause of death worldwide, with increasing rate in children and adults. In 2015, the estimate shows that 600 million adults and 100 million children were obese in 195 countries. Causes. Obesity is caused by eating more calories than you burn through exercise and normal daily activities. As a result, your body stores these excess calories as fat. Common specific causes of obesity include inactivity, having a sedentary lifestyle, unhealthy eating, such as eating a poor diet of foods high in calories, lack of sleep. This can lead to hormonal changes that can increase your appetite. You may also crave foods high in calories, which can contribute to weight gain. Genetics can play a role in how your body converts food into energy and how your body burns calories during exercise. Pregnancy. Sometimes weight gained during pregnancy may be hard to lose, eventually leading to obesity. Aging, which can lead to a decrease in the amount of muscle in your body. This decreased muscle mass leads to a slower metabolic rate, making it easier to gain weight. Certain medications may cause weight gain or changes in the body composition, such as insulin, antidepressants, steroids, and some form of hormonal contraception.
Hi, my name is Carla Arigante. I'm a family therapist and addiction specialist. How to perform an intervention. The initial and most important step to the intervention process is planning.
A family member or friend proposes an intervention and forms a planning group. It's best if you consult with an intervention professional, a qualified professional counselor, or a social worker when planning an intervention. An intervention is a highly charged situation that has the potential to cause anger, resentment, and a sense of betrayal. If you have any concerns that the intervention may trigger anger or violent behavior, consult an intervention professional before taking any action.
Forming the team.
The planning group forms a team that will personally participate in the intervention. Team members set aside a date and location and work together to present a consistent, rehearsed message and structured treatment plan. Do not let your loved one know what you are doing until the day of the intervention.
Next, gather all your information and have a plan ready.
The group members should find out about the extent of the loved one's problem and research the conditions and treatment programs. The group may make arrangements to enroll the loved one in a specific treatment program.
Write down what to say.
Each member of the intervention team should write down specific incidences where the addiction resulted in problems, such as emotional or financial issues. Discuss the toll of your loved one's behavior while still expressing care and the expectation that your loved one can change.
Deciding on specific consequences.
If your loved one doesn't accept treatment, each person on the team needs to decide what action he or she will take. Examples including asking your loved one to move out or taking away the contact with the children.
The intervention meeting.
Without revealing the reason, the loved one is asked to the intervention site. Members of the core team take turns expressing their concerns and feelings. The loved one is presented with the treatment options and asked to accept the option on the spot. Each team member will say specific changes they wish to make if the addicted person doesn't accept the plan.
The final step to the intervention process is follow-up.
Involving spouse, family members, and others is critical in helping someone with addiction stay in treatment and avoid relapse. This can include changing patterns of everyday living to make it easier to avoid destructive behavior, offering to participate in counseling with your loved one, seeking your own therapist and recovery support, and knowing what to do if relapse occurs.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no war, it's fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When a system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is your brother, Vladimir Deese. There comes a time when you have to have an intervention with the people, with a person, should I say. And in order to have the intervention and to do it right, you have to speak truth in such a sharpened fashion that it feels like they are being assaulted. The person who you are talking to, it feels like they are being assaulted by a greater force than that which you are trying to intervene in separating them from. The comments have to be sharp. The thought processes have to be complete. The ability to ignore the attempts by the fragile personality created to maintain the addiction. At the heart, this personality is completely animalistic. It is completely psychopathic. It is almost demonic how detached it is from the actual structure inside the person. Ignoring that is key to succeeding in the intervention. So begins this episode, which is likely to be a little bit shorter than normal other episodes that I would do for you. The inspiration for this episode comes from
a conversation that I had with a man who I work with periodically. His leanings is, quote, conservative, but he's a very different conservative than I am. And him and I had a conversation one day about beliefs and what was really pulling apart people in this country. And I said to him that the idea, as I've expressed to you before, the idea which was doing the most harm to the American people wasn't the idea of Democrats or Republicans, even though you're talking about two different systems when you're talking about those labels. But it was the idea that progressivism and conservatism were somehow disconnected. And as I've explained to you before, I explained to him, you can no longer have conservatism and progressivism be separated. Then you can have a tree from its leaves. A tree, by its very existence, will always, to some extent, have some leaf or pod or what have you that performs photosynthesis. There's probably like one that doesn't, and, you know, I don't know about it, but most of them do. They're both connected. Or even more, you can no longer have conservatism and progressivism be separated from each other. Then you can have a baby from an adult be separated from one another. They're both interlocking. The baby is someday going to grow into an adult, unless obviously there is an interjection there that stops the baby from growing into an adult, i.e. death. So, on another occasion, because he was intrigued by that, him and I had another conversation. And he asked me about Black Lives Matter. And I recounted for him the story that I've recounted for you, which was of the man down in Texas. You could go back and listen to my George Floyd series in order to hear that one. But I said to him, after recounting the story, I said, look, man, Black people always have cherished life. When white people are in the house of Black people, your life matters. When we in your house, we don't know if our life matters. But I said to him, that is actually not the most important question that I've found over these last 3 years. The question to me is whether or not that statement is true that you say in response that all lives matter. In fact, I would even delineate it down. Because some people, in response to Black Lives Matter, used to write White Lives Matter. But because of how that sounded, they stopped doing it and they started writing All Lives Matter. And he was like, oh, I didn't know about that. I'm like, yeah, I did. I remember it. But it sounded racist, so they stopped doing it, and then it became All Lives Matter. Okay. Well, let me ask you this. Does white lives really matter? And he paused, and he stopped, and he said, what do you mean? And I said, my point exactly. What do I mean? Because, you know, you guys are always quick to be like, well, does black lives really matter? About, you know, black people, they're killing each other. Like, yeah, well, let's look at the death that white people cause to other white people. Yes, it's true. Yes, black people are more likely to die of what you call violent crimes, gunshots, stabbings, things like that, which is expected in a poverty situation, by the way. You can go back and you can look at the Irish, the Polish, and the other European groups that were in urban settings, and take a look at the violence that was executed there. Hell, they make movies about that stuff. And you'd see that the same level of violence was occurring with them that happened with black people. But let's talk about the other side of white-on-white violence. Because white-on-white violence takes a different form. than what you call black-on-black violence. You have hundreds of thousands of people dying in this country, the richest country that has literally ever existed in the history of this world. You have hundreds of thousands of white people dying from opioids. Opioids that were created by white people, distributed by white people, the majority of the people who are working at these companies that created it and are and thus act as distributors are white. Pharmaceuticals, the majority of those are white. You have people dying from that. And yet, you don't want to regulate the companies that are pushing that stuff out. You have another hundreds of thousands of people that are dying from complications really due to pharmaceuticals. But oftentimes they're not marked down as complications due to pharmaceuticals. People take a pill and it causes five different problems to the one that it's supposed to solve. And then you have to give them more pills to solve those problems. And sooner or later, the body just can't function and the person dies. But we don't count that as that. You have tens of thousands of people that die because of maladies picked up from work, from employment, but we don't count that. You have hundreds of thousands of people dying because they don't have health care insurance in the richest country that has ever existed on this planet. And while, yes, a lot of those are not white, the fact that the perpetrators of this death is white, I count it. So do all lives really matter? Yes, let's make all lives matter, but this is a fact. If you want to just count stabbings and shootings as violence, then yes, black people are doing really, really bad. But the dictionary conspires against you. This is really what violence looks like. Poverty is violence. Deprivation in a nation of plenty is violence. White lives do not matter to other white people. Yet you want to have a discussion about whether black lives matter to other black people. When we had our own communities, which I encourage black people to build again because you guys are incapable of building a society that works. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, I want to be very honest with you. I keep telling conservatives that because these folks are walking around in a fog and a daze, believing that they are really the greatest thing that ever happened to this planet. And it's just untrue. Their society is a joke around the world, and particularly in Europe. Their society is used to teach up-and-coming generations what not to do if you want a healthy society. The Anglo-American project, economic project, which we call neoliberalism, it's really neoliberalism and neoconservatism, is folly writ large. So I tell them that. But I continue. I said, look, man, you know, when we had our own communities, we took care of each other. I mean, we didn't agree on everything, but we took care of each other. We had a stronger, what you call welfare mandate, to do good for the entire whole than you did. And if white people got hurt or wanted to come and work over, they did. I recounted for him the story of Greenwood and how there were white people who would come over and work in the black community and would say, damn, I got treated better over there than I did among my own people, which he was shocked about. But continuing, I said, the thing is, my man, is if white lives don't matter to other white people, I can't expect black lives to matter to y'all. I can't. So that was the second conversation. The third conversation, which needed to happen, and I'm going to expand on it here, was about interventions. Him and I were again talking about Black Lives Matter. And I said to him, I said, you know, we were kind of deep into the conversation. I said, look, man, let me ask you a question. I go, because, you know, you really think that this has to do with black people, don't you? And he's like, well, y'all don't want to ask him for Black Lives Matter, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, yeah, because we're trying to get you to see a broader point. The humanist concept, which I know conservatives like to make a horrible mockery out of, but it's a fact. Europeans, particularly European Americans, have a horrible time seeing humanitarianism and the need for it constantly and consistently. Every generation, it's almost like they have to be retold that this is what they have to strive towards. So while we're talking about Black Lives Matter, we're really jumping around the issue. The issue is that the Anglo-American economic project, which is really political economic project, needs an intervention. White people need an intervention. Because y'all are lost. And he goes, what do you mean? And what do you mean by intervention? I'm like, exactly what I mean by an intervention is what do you do in an intervention? You sit the person down and you say, you doing this. This is hurting everybody around you. You need to stop. And this is where Anglo-European political economy has gotten us, where the world needs to sit Europe down and say, you need to stop because you're hurting everybody else. He said, he was a little bit shocked. He's like, well, what do you mean? What do you mean? And I go, you guys built through exploitation, through murder, through slaughtering, through a host of things that other people did not do to you. You built a system of exploitation, which you have been benefiting from since you left your little area of your continent. You then rewrote the history books to make it sound as if you were more noble than you actually were when you did what you did. Then when finally your egotism, your vanity, your technology brought you not once but twice to the brink of annihilating not only yourselves, but in the second case, the power to annihilate the world. That's the atomic bomb and World War I and World War II, in case y'all don't get it. When you were finally forced to put some checks on your ambitions because of how dangerous they had become. And again, this was you. You ran the world. Instead of accepting those checks, instead of accepting those limitations, instead of accepting the fact that you're going to now have to treat everybody who you had been telling yourself was less than you because they didn't move towards ambitioning themselves in order to gain what you got. Instead of settling on that and saying, fine, we can make the world work without this naked aggression that we have been executing across the world, you sought to put into place a new system which, again, profited and benefited you by the same means as you used to build it. And he goes, well, I didn't do that. And I go, no, but you are part of this. You want to claim the conservatism, man, you claim it. Because this is, when you talk about economic conservatism, which doesn't exist, conservatism is not an economic system. it's a philosophy. It's a philosophy that's built to maintain and to hold together what works. But when you align it with economy, this is what you're pulling forward. This is what you're pulling forward. And with these people putting this new system in place, the goal wasn't prosperity for the planet. No matter what they tell you, it was never prosperity for the planet. It was prosperity for the Anglo-American alliance. That was it. Trilateralism, which occurred in the 1970s, added the Japanese as kind of a counterweight to the possibility of China rising, because everybody knew China was going to rise. As soon as it started westernizing its processes, everybody was like, oop, China's going to be the next big thing. But even with China, China and Russia both have the same illness that Europe has, which is that they see the world as an oyster which they are alone meant to eat from. That's what they see. And so, as we've been watching over the last 70, 80 years and waiting for you guys to grow past this stage, I mean, this is a stage that you expect from a child. This unhealthy but necessary growth. So you expect a child to continuously, and actually I guess it would be a healthy growth, but when you're looking at how you did it, it was unhealthy. But you expect this growth from a child. How you influence that growth is you give them the foods that are going to make them the healthiest they can be. The problem with Europe was, during their expansionist phase, the food which they fed upon was dominance, enslavement, exploitation, the idea of racial hierarchy. They fed on all the things that a demagogue needs to seize power. And instead of claiming the fact that it was they alone who put the system together, they often blame the people who they were victimizing. We are now at a period of time, I said, where all of that mind state, that mindset, that childish expansionism is over. It's done. And the world has been waiting for the last 50 years for the United States to finally come to terms with that. But now the world, as it's watching the United States start to shake and shimmer and truthfully fall apart, the world is contemplating whether or not the U.S. needs an intervention. Now, what will an intervention look like? Will it be as simple as we'll sit down around the negotiating table and we'll come up with a new format in which this whole planet can be shared by us all? Or will the U.S. follow the path that it has laid out in so many of its blockbuster movies? Oh yeah, you think you coming in and getting me? Only over my dead body. Only over my dead body. We will shoot it out. Is that the type of intervention that's going to come about from all this? And y'all need it. Oh God, do y'all need it. Consumerism is an addictive force. It is an addiction that has captured so much of the society that it is destructive. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm recording this on Christmas. For the first time in years, I wanted nothing to do with Christmas music. Since I was a little child, Christmas was my favorite time of the year because there is a magicness to it. People were lighter. People were happier. People were, okay, this also started last year too, but still, there was this power to it that renewed the spirit. I've started noticing this over the last 10 years. People were not becoming renewed by this energy anymore. And it's all because of the hyper-consumption. And it's kind of ironic that people want to still hyperly consume this year with the pandemic. The pandemic should be stopping them from hyperly consuming, and they still want to hyperly consume because they don't know anything else to do. That's an addiction. Oh, that's an addiction. So my friend, who listened to me go on for a while about this, said, man, you've really put some thought into this. And I'm like, yeah, I have. I've been, you know, looking at the problems of this country and this society for much of the last 10 years, even though I didn't know that's what I was doing half the time, but that's what I was doing. And so, you know, after a day or so, he came back to me and he's like, yo, man, so, you know, we were talking about this yesterday. Let me ask you a question. Do you see us? Do you think we'll be able to, the society will be able to solve its problems? And I said, well, you're asking me the question, man. What do you think? And he goes, nah, I think we're pretty done. And I go, yeah, that's probably about it. But not necessarily. Not necessarily. And he goes, why? And I go, because one of the greatest things, and not a good thing, but it is a greater thing, that this pandemic has done is it has, it's peeled off this notion that poverty is not widespread. For the last 40 years, poverty has been hidden under free market manipulations. Because the news doesn't show the people in line waiting for food baskets, but we'll just talk about the story of, oh yes, you know, food baskets are going out, you know, during Christmas and Thanksgiving, and so everything's good, because they don't cover the fact that food covers have been increasingly under more and more stress, especially over the last 10 years. People have been able to ignore that. But now, the reason why the news is covering it is because so many of their friends, so many of their middle-class friends are having to go to food covers. Poverty is everywhere. When Bernie Sanders, and again, he's a conservative, and he's not a fan of AOC, he's not a fan of Bernie Sanders, which I will not get into the conversation we had on that. But I said, when Bernie Sanders constantly talked about people living paycheck to paycheck, you didn't think you were among that, did you? And he kind of paused a little bit, and he looked at me, and he's like, well, no, because my wife this and my wife that. I'm like, how much money do you have in a bank right now? I'm not talking about 401ks or anything. How much money do you have in a bank right now? And he goes, oh, yeah, we've been pretty lucky. We got a few thousand. And I go, okay. I said, do you have 10,000? He goes, maybe a little bit more than that. I'm like, okay, good. I'm glad. I said, I don't, but you do. Let's say, God forbid, your wife gets sick. And he goes, oh, I know where you're going with this. And I'm like, do you? Let's say your wife gets sick. She's sick for a month. Can't go to work. So now you're eating away at your money in the bank. For a month. Not huge, but for a month. You're going to get unemployment probably during that month. So, boom. You get that bill. And let's say that bill is for $4,000. So now, boom. Yeah, okay, we're paying, we'll just use $4,000, there you go. Next time we get our taxes, we're just going to fill it back in. A year later, your wife gets sick again. Out again for a month. Okay, same thing happens, $4,000, blah, 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 blah. The next year, she gets sick a third time. But this time it dogs her throughout the year. So you have to pay your copay, which let's say is $2,500, or not your the amount that you got to pay before your insurance kicks in. And then your wife needs to go in and start having all, she needs to start seeing these specialists. She has to start going in for tests and things like that. And so it's like, you know, it's $50 here, it's $20 there, it's $150 here, maybe $400 here. You got to have blood work. So now, you know, that's $100, or that's $40, blah, 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 blah. Next thing you know, by the end of that year, instead of $4,000 worth of medical bills, you have $8,000. Now your wife isn't better. And you slip and you fall and hurt your back. The next year, both you and her have medical bills. Automatically, you know you're going to have $5,000 worth of medical bills until your, or maybe it'll be the same $2,500 until it kicks in. So you already know that's going to be $2,500 out of your pocket. Now you're going to work, and she's still going to work, but she's had to take less, fewer hours because of that. What I'm telling you is, I just gave you a 5-year scenario of how you'd suddenly be working paycheck to paycheck. And it didn't take much. If that sickness had started dogging your wife in that first year, man, within 2 years you would be living paycheck to paycheck. You are living paycheck to paycheck, but you don't see yourself as that. And he's like, well, I guess you're right. I guess you're right. Wow. Man, I guess you're right. And I said, look, man, it's not about me being right. It's about you recognizing where your interests are. You're arguing for a bunch of billionaires, and we went off on that. But these are the walls, ladies and gentlemen. The intervention that needs to take place needs to get people to, too many progressives, I think, when they think of like, okay, how are we going to change the mind of conservatives? It's like, just hit them with facts, hit them with facts, hit them with facts, hit them with facts. Ladies and gentlemen, facts are cold and they're disconnected. Plus, there has been a war against facts. When a person is addicted, facts don't matter. Facts don't matter. You can go to them and you can tell them all day long that this is destroying their body, that this is destroying their family. But until you get the points sharp enough where it starts jabbing at that connection, they won't believe you. You bring it home. You bring it home. And with white people particularly, you're dealing with a people who have been traumatize themselves. Go back to Europe. Look at what was done at the hands of other white people. Look at what was done at the hands of other white people. But also, these people have come from that situation. They haven't even wanted to deal with the psychological trauma of what they did to their own people, particularly the wealthy people. They come from that trauma to inflict that trauma on other people. And they have been living in a fantasy about that trauma. Ever since. Every generation, they double down on that trauma. Every generation, they double down on the falseness of the beautifulness of them, of their being. They take the trauma that they inflict on other people. They take the terror that they inflict on other people and they reverse it. They invert it. They toss it at the other person and say it's their fault. This is the act. actual demonic portion, which feeds the addiction. One of the greatest, man, the beginning of Rick Perlstein's book, The Invisible Bridge, where he talks about the idea that America in the 1960s was ready to grow up, and that why so many liberals hate Ronald Reagan is because what Ronald Reagan did was Ronald Reagan stopped that process. Ronald Reagan stopped that process. He said, no, not only are we not going to grow up, but we are going to double down and hang on to this majestic past that isn't that majestic. And you still hear it today. You still hear it today. When I said to my friend about, you know, I was reading this book, and I recounted to him the fact that the author had written about that, he said, well, I don't really believe that. And I go, I know you don't believe it. Look at what you just said. I don't really believe that. You don't believe that Ronald Reagan stopped America from growing up. Ronald Reagan literally told you that he's going to make America great again. He was the first guy to use that. I think he was the first guy to use it. But that was what he built his entire campaign around. That we used to be great. Now we have to find that greatness again. Ladies and gentlemen, basically this is what Ronald Reagan said. Look around you. All of the problems is because we got away from what made us great. When in fact, no, the problems were arising because we were trying to figure out how to get away from the problems and fix the problems that were there previously. And what Ronald Reagan did, as did Jimmy Carter, as did Ford, as did Nixon, was they said, hey, let's do this. We'll just go back to what we used to do. And you've seen this, by the way. I didn't tell him this, but I'll tell you this. In the story of what happened with New York City when it was facing bankruptcy, it's funny how New York City had to go to the private market and sell itself off. Just like back in, I think it was either 1899, 1900, and 1901, when the U.S. federal government had run out of money and had to go to J.P. Morgan Chase for a loan. That's when they said what made America great again, that's what they were talking about. This addiction will have to be broken. It'll have to be broken. What is going to be the cost of breaking it? I don't know. But it will have to be broken. We are going to have to do it. In some forms, I think the pandemic is doing it for us. But we're still going to have to do it. Thankfully, I thought this was going to actually be around 25 minutes. But, you know, it's over 30. Questions, comments, concerns. Reach out to me, y'all. I'm your brother, Vimer Dees. There's a shadow peace on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone.